want, where and when they want it, and in what form. As we move closer to a real-time world, the term access will have widening application, going beyond the confines of ready provision of mere information to the delivery of products and services. The old adage of location, location, location being the three most important advantages in retailing now applies to almost every consumer-oriented service. While the Internet is the most technically sophisticated and extreme application of this idea, other developments are equally striking and tremendous in scope. It was not too many years ago when gas stations were the primary contender for the best locations in every big and small town. Now ATMs, fast food outlets, specialty coffee shops, and video rental stores seem to vie for space on every street corner. Ubiquity is the order of the day. Blockbuster, the video rental chain, has 5,021 stores worldwide and is adding new ones at the rate of one every 11 hours. McDonald's, which had 11,803 restaurants worldwide in 1990, grew to 18,380 in 1995. Vendors of consumer electronics like Best Buy and Circuit City are opening new stores at the rate of 25% of their total outlets a quarter. People at Taco Bell refer to their 1,500-plus outlets as POAs, or points of access, or any place people eat, a supermarket, airport, school cafeteria, college campus, or street corner. Customers must have easy and quick access to satisfaction, whether they need help with a purchase, a reorder, a check on order status, or catalog information, or want to air their frustrations. Businesses have gotten this message. Telephone companies are almost sold out of 800 numbers in the United States, with 97% of all currently available numbers in use. Whether the 800 numbers belong to Hershey's Chocolates, Kellogg's Raisin Bran, Intuit's Quicken, or Dell Computers, they offer service, value, and above all, dialogue. Studies show that consumers believe 800 numbers on products connote quality inside. Use of an answering machine and taped reply message is not the way to deal with consumers. From dialogue, companies must build databases, respond to suggestions and criticism, and customize products or services. This is how the customer satisfaction loop for the never-satisfied customer should be completed. Access has a way of revitalizing old industries and businesses. One of the best examples is book publishing and bookstores. Kicking a bit of sand in Nicholas Negroponte's all-digital world theory that books will vanish, Americans bought 1.5 billion books in 1995, an increase of more than 30% since 1991. In the last decade, bookstores have popped up everywhere. Two of my favorite stores are tucked away in the small villages of Kona and Wailea on the island of Hawaii. Their new computer-based inventory systems allow them to special order from distributors in Honolulu or the mainland online, giving them the chance to hold their own against the large superstores and other competitors. These rivals include the ultimate accessible bookstore, Amazon.com, an online operation that boasts an inventory of 2.5 million book titles. It's great to browse from home. I have an account billed to my credit card. The Amazon.com service department is helpful and responsive, replying by email to address problems and notifying you when your order is being shipped. It also maintains a database on customer orders and informs you when your favorite author has published again. Amazon.com has one-upped Barnes & Noble. While I enjoy browsing and having a cup of cappuccino at the bookstore from time to time, I find the quick and easy access to Amazon.com saves me time. And I buy more books. As we morph from the age of computing and information to the age of communications, technological progress is opening the door wide to a content-rich multimedia dialogue. In 1985, the average personal computer contained 128 kilobytes of RAM memory and 256 kilobytes of hard disk storage. Today, the average personal computer has 32 megabytes of RAM and 1 gigabyte, 1 billion bytes of disk storage. To express this progression in more familiar terms, a personal computer, circa 1985, could store only 500 pages of text. Today, on my computer with a 1.2 gigabyte disk drive, I can store more than 7 million pages. Now consider the same progression, only speeded up and applied to the bandwidth of communications. Increased bandwidth means more than greater speed of transmission and reception. It also means having the capacity to send and receive video images and sound in real time. Because progress in expanding bandwidth, expressed in bits per second, or the rate at which bits flow through your telephone line or the cable to your TV, lags far behind the rate of advance in MIPS, millions of instructions per second, or the rate at which computers process data of any kind, our ability to replicate face-to-face interaction in its fullest dimensions through telephone, cable, or wireless communication is still quite primitive today. An average computer is capable of handling less than a minute of video. 1 megabyte of storage can hold only 50 spoken words, 5 photographs, and 5 seconds of video. But these capacities are about to change dramatically. In the early part of the 21st century, the communications infrastructure will begin to accommodate two-way dialogue in an interactive television-like environment, at prices most consumers will be able to afford. George Gilder, the most enthusiastic proponent of bandwidth expansion, vividly expresses the scope of the new revolution. Like the great river headed for a falls, a new factor of production is racing toward a historic cliff of costs. Over the next 30 years, the spearhead of wealth creation will be the telecosm, marked by the plummeting cost of bandwidth, communications power, measured in gigabits per second. I have already had more than a glimpse of this technological watershed. My home is slated to be a beta site for the at-home joint venture with Telecommunications Incorporated, or TCI, that allows access to the Internet via cable. This will increase my download speed to 10 megabytes per second, millions, a huge improvement over my high-speed ISDN line's capacity of only about 156 kilobytes, thousands, per second. I will be able to download a 90-minute movie in about 10 minutes versus 4 hours by ISDN or 2.5 days over my telephone line. Video conferencing from living rooms and desktop computers with the clarity of high-definition television will make for more engaging conferences, team meetings, and exchanges of consumer feedback, and it will enhance the illusion of being there that television first created. The technologies of acceleration in themselves are of little interest to the average consumer. But speed means bandwidth, and bandwidth means dialogue, which in turn also means more control and choice of content by consumers. It is interaction, something consumers love. As I have shown in Chapter 2, the dialogue that bandwidth makes possible allows consumers to satisfy many of their needs themselves. As a result, somewhat paradoxically, while consumers take more control over what and how they buy, they are, in another sense, more open to being influenced and guided by companies. From data content to people content. Recent developments in technology such as the Internet are propelling advances in a panoply of delivery mechanisms and information services, including interactive TV and desktop video conferencing. What is the most important implication of all these new communications media that are digital, cheap, and bidirectional? Because they are digital, the various forms of media can be mixed and matched. Video, voice, data, and graphics can all be combined into new forms for human interaction. And what this in turn means is that just as the left and right brain work together to allow such complex and delicate experiences as feeling, enjoying, understanding, and trusting, the new media will permit infinitely more subtle communication and nuanced human interaction. It is this capacity for the exchange of complex human experience, rather than the hardware and software that now get so much attention, that will come to be associated with computer power. Bandwidth expansion allows for a much fuller range of human expression. Information is, after all, something far richer than our conventional notion of it as data stored in computer warehouses. Visual and aural cues are part of it. But going even further than that, we often forget that the most important aspect of information is the expression and acceptance of its meaning. It is a smile, a frown, a head shake, a hug, and a kiss. We may not get to the stage where computers kiss, but they will certainly be able to mimic human emotions in a far more satisfying way. The closer technology comes to delivering the subtleties of human expression, the more we will come to rely on it for human interaction, in the marketplace as much as anywhere else. You might say that as the bandwidth of expression expands, people become content. Knowledge, as well as graphic, intimate, even viscerally affecting human experiences, will become the common currency of exchange and interaction. From fixed boundaries to open space. A few years ago, I heard an inventor named Paul McCready speak on the subject of new ideas at the Technology Museum in San Jose. Best known as the father of human-powered flight, McCready, an American, won Britain's Kramer Prizes for two accomplishments: sustaining human-powered flight over a fixed course and then across the English Channel with the Gossamer Condor and Gossamer Albatross, both of which he designed and built himself. At the lecture I attended, he retold the story recounted in his book, The Flying Gossamer, of how he won a prize of £50,000 for designing a flimsy aircraft made of balsa wood, paper, and other light materials. He had pulled off something that many of his aeronautical engineer colleagues and a variety of other specialists vying for the award had failed to accomplish. Nearly everything about McCready's approach effectively threw out 100 years of theory about aircraft design. McCready said he had entered the competition chiefly because he needed the money. He figured that all he had to do was make his craft as light as possible, an aim he accomplished in part by using his 10-year-old son as pilot, and keep the Gossamer airborne for just long enough to win. He gave no thought to accessories for his creation or to its looks, having decided that it didn't even have to look like a plane. The Gossamer literally fell apart as it flew, but that worked to McCready's advantage, lightening the load on the craft as his son's pedaling power wound downward. McCready said that the lesson he learned was, "Someone else always determines how we think." In their design attempts, the other competitors had all gone by the book without ever once asking the question, why are we stuck on these rules? Certainly, with the exception of rare, wild individuals like McCready, few of us stand to profit from discounting the experience and understanding of those who have gone before us. Yet, many theories, practices, and procedures become institutionalized. They are never challenged or questioned, and as a result, they actually block ideas about new and better ways of doing things. Particularly in business, thinking is too often a captive of the past, of past leaders' approaches to everything from organizational structure to the importance accorded one or another management specialization to the way the outside world is viewed and tackled. The modern organizational chart reflects management science's early 20th century fondness for boxes, strictly divided and segregated corporate functions and managerial disciplines, roles, and responsibilities. The walls between the boxes restrict the talents and contributions of the employees they enclose to particular spheres of operation. Within each box, employees' identities are a matter of rigid categorization by function, job description, and pay level. In government organizations, which perhaps most closely resemble the Orwellian nightmare of 1984, employees to this day describe themselves as level 2 managers or something similar. The top-to-bottom overhaul in organizational practices, instigated by the Japanese-inspired total quality management revolution, taught managers about the drawbacks of boundaries and boxes. Quality, they learned, could not be the sole concern of a specialized department at the end of the line, a line beginning with a product development box and ending with a box marked production. Quality had to become everyone's job. It had to be integrated into design, manufacturing, distribution, and service, which in turn meant that all these managerial functions could not be operationally segregated. Jamshid Gadajadagi, president and CEO of Interact, former director of the Bush Center, and adjunct professor of system sciences at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, reminds us that TQM has required managers to rethink organizational cultures. The organization is redesigned to create a new platform for effective interactions among the purposeful members of the organization. It is to produce a shared understanding and commitment to a collective vision of a desired future. By dissolving paralyzing conflicts, this vision empowers the members to pursue their desired ends and help them redefine, as needed, the operational targets. redesign of the structure is to create a multidimensional network of internal and external producers, designers, and marketers for multiple utilization of the value chain and key competency. The multidimensional network can become a vehicle for sharing and managing the capacity within the system and its environment to minimize vulnerability. TQM, like real-time, tears down the walls and boxes. The coming of the Internet has added fresh impetus to managerial disaggregation. In one of the most striking illustrations of its possibilities, Paul Ambrose, a database software genius, set up his development company, WebLogic, in his living room in 1995. He and a couple of friends developed a set of network software products that allowed data to migrate easily between corporate databases and the Internet. When the group's first products were completed, beta versions were put up on the net. No marketing or press releases whatsoever were issued. No Salesforce, no distributors, no retailers signed up in advance of launch. Within 6 weeks, Ambrose had more than 1,000 corporate and government sites testing his programs. His users included people in financial services companies, healthcare, retailing, and consumer businesses based in Japan, the United Kingdom, and France, as well as the United States. Without boundaries, Paul's homegrown business is booming. Many job titles and time-honored functions within organizations are clearly changing, and some are destined to become extinct. Responsibilities are increasingly apt to overlap and clash. For instance, the roles of the CEO and the marketing VP often conflict. It becomes more and more difficult to say which of these managers should have a greater say in matters of a company's strategy, product direction, alliances and partnerships with other companies, and relations with Wall Street. For organizations, incalculable benefits will come from collaborations or linkages between departments of design and manufacturing, of sales, distribution and service, and of marketing and engineering. And all of these relationships will be intensified and refined by intranets. They will make for enhanced speed, improved economies, and toned competitive muscle. Dave Packard, the legendary co-founder of Hewlett-Packard, once said that the development of new ideas is not limited by resources or technology, but by another type of boundary, the limits of the imagination. But in its elevation lies the risk that creativity will be treated as a discrete process, just as quality control once was. Powerful and effective ideas are unlikely to emerge from isolating creativity on a pedestal. Instead, managers must learn to immerse themselves in their company's actual circumstances, partly by using the information tools of the age of real time to constantly update the facts at their disposal, and partly by seeking as much direct contact as possible with customers, customers' customers, and the products and services of competitors. Creative thinking will arise naturally from a visceral sense of the state of things and from early intimations of new openings and opportunities. Awareness acquired by an unbounded and active engagement with the environment. We do not yet know how to live in a boundary-free world. For roughly the past 20 years, popular business theories have been based on corporate self-improvement. Organizations and their performance have been scrutinized, evaluated, and reshaped into leaner and more effective structures. Trends such as managing by walking around, focusing on core competencies, developing value propositions, entrepreneuring, re-engineering, and downsizing all encourage a certain self-centered perspective in organizations. I do not want to imply that these approaches are necessarily wrong. I believe, however, that most business theorists and theories of the last quarter century direct too much attention inward and too little to external forces of change. Michael Porter may be one exception. In his book, The Competitive Advantage, he tells us, "Every industry has an underlying structure or a set of fundamental economic and technical characteristics that gives rise to competitive forces. The strategist, wanting to position his company to cope best with its industry environment or to influence that environment in the company's favor, must learn what makes the environment tick." Knowing what makes an industry tick in a real-time marketplace means keeping track of all the forces affecting it in real time. From the satisfied to the self-satisfied consumer. The line separating products from services is rapidly disappearing. Marketers who build sturdy and enduring relationships with consumers act on the understanding that integral to successful product marketing is the establishment of an information-rich customer environment characterized by exceptional attentiveness, convenience, assurance, and comfort. In other words, service. In the shift from products to services, specialized knowledge and human understanding rise to the forefront. Service has long been a person-to-person activity. What healthcare, financial services, consulting, dry cleaning, and auto repair and maintenance all have in common is that they require specific expertise and exchange of information, and that their valuation is generally a function of time. Quality is related to both time and service. If, for example, my car is in the repair shop too often, I am well aware that I am losing time. If my healthcare provider forces me to change doctors, I must take the time to retell my medical history and establish a new relationship. Businesses have to address the frustration associated with lost time felt by consumers whose daily schedules are already jam-packed. They must address it by valuing their customers' time. Service for the consumer is time value. When I receive a fax or send one, time is compressed. When I use an ATM or buy from a Land's End catalog, space is transformed. When a problem is solved quickly or a product replaced with no questions asked, the message I get is that the consumer's time is valued. Real-time technology delivers an immediate service and transaction experience wherever I am. In a real-time world, the shopping mall becomes as readily accessible as if I were actually there, the service representative as if he were at my elbow. My firm is a service business. Earlier this year, I gave a presentation to one of our clients in Tokyo. Four members of my project team, including my partner Hiroshi Menjo, who heads our Japan practice, had to remain in Palo Alto. Because Hiroshi understands the technology and had worked on the project, he and the team were able to participate in the presentation through teleconferencing. I made the presentation. Hiroshi translated for my audience in Tokyo. It wasn't perfect, but it turned out far better than any of us had imagined. We saved both our customers and ourselves time, and when questions arose, delivered the necessary expertise. The cellular telephone, satellite communications, and convenience marketing have all been changing our perceptions of space so that this truth is only now dawning on us. Owing to the apparent reconfiguration of time and space, products and services are not distinct but part of a continuum, and the distinction between products and services will continue to erode as diversity, choice, and competition force producers to think differently about time, space, and service. Thoughts on a real-time world. Service is a speed and response business. Investing in the technologies of self-service is the way companies will collapse waiting time and create memorably congenial experiences of interaction for their customers. It is this, I believe, that will create lasting brand loyalty. An 800 phone number, fax number, and a URL on the product for phone, fax, or online registration are real-time service and brand-building opportunities that would turn Kathy into a very happy customer. As I've shown in Chapter 2, my definition of perfection in service is customers serving themselves so effortlessly through transparent technological intermediaries that they are hardly aware of doing so. The telephone industry made this switch many years ago. For 50 years, telephone operators sat at switchboards waiting on callers. In the 1930s, relay switching systems transferred that task to the person making the phone call. In the 1960s, push-button phones turned the caller into a computer operator by providing a computer keypad on the phone that allows calls and data to be directed to millions of possible receivers. To my knowledge, no one complained about having to become his or her own telephone operator. Today, computers, software, and the networks turn everyone into researcher, publisher, order clerk, and bank teller. For companies properly primed for the five kinds of discontinuity I've described in this chapter, each shift will seem like a booster rocket that, even as it jars the frames of corporate spacecraft and tests managers' nerves, will shoot them into galaxies of undreamed-of opportunities. The real-time message. Real-time managers will be different from today's in five important ways. They will not sacrifice economies of time for economies of scale. they will understand that consumers given more control over what and how they buy through dialogue with companies are paradoxically consumers more open to being guided by companies. They will use both inside and outside their companies new media allowing unprecedentedly subtle and nuanced human interaction. They will have seen how real-time tears down organizational walls and boxes, just like TQM. They will invest heavily in technologies that let customers satisfy themselves. Chapter 7. Preparing for the eventuality of anything. There is a single most common reaction from audiences I have been addressing about the age of real-time. Well, the very first person to raise a hand at question time is likely to say, "It's all fascinating, but what do we do about it?" In the introduction to this book, I mentioned Alvin Toffler's hope in writing Future Shock that his readers, being properly prepared for the technology-driven seismic jolts in store for us, would handle these disturbances more deftly than the uninstructed and unprepared. But if the nearly three decades since his book's debut have taught us anything, it is that managers of organizations cannot, in fact, prepare for the age of real time in the way they might for driving a car down a crowded street, piloting a plane, or dealing with interpersonal difficulties. There are decades worth of precedents for coping with problems of that sort, but practically none for what a successful transition to real time entails, which is, above all, preparing for the eventuality of anything. For most people, it entails a profound change in attitude and the acquisition of a new set of habits. A primer for real-time management. The best metaphor for the right way to approach real-time might be the modus operandi of the reigning star of the private as opposed to government weather forecasting business, the head of the meteorology department of Smith Barney's commodity trading arm. What is clear from a detailed account of how this expert, John Davis, works is that forecasting is a complete misnomer for what he actually does, which is to stay so closely attuned to every available computer readout and analysis from every data-gathering instrument, measuring, for instance, wind, barometric pressure, and temperature, that he does not predict the weather so much as virtually live on top of changing weather patterns. He even monitors data sources that his less successful competitors never fuss with. According to an article in the New York Times, one arcane factor that Mr. Davis tracks but few others bother to chart is the wave-like patterns over months in air pressures at specific latitudes that help track changes in the jet stream. Leaders in real-time management will use all the tools at their disposal to achieve a similar, tireless monitoring of indicators of gestating patterns, cross-currents, and undercurrents in technologies, markets, and industries. The balance of this section of the chapter comprises my answer to the question of what organizations should do to prime themselves for managing in the age of real-time. Expand your toolkit of sensors. If you currently rely on toll-free telephone numbers for customer feedback, add a website at which your customers can refine and expand their dialogue with you. If you already have a website and an 800 number, add transaction capabilities to your real-time data-gathering resources. Invest in and continually refine your human interface software, adding multimedia technologies, and pushing the edges of bandwidth to entice your customers and employees, and keep them engaged with entertaining interaction. Maintaining an interface of this sort is challenging and expensive, but you will be rewarded with intense involvement and non-stop information feedback. Most important, this compelling front-end interface must be tied into a database, a network, and feedback procedures. As a kind of personal informal investigation into how much progress companies have been making in this direction, and to satisfy my curiosity, I have developed a habit of calling 800 numbers I read on packages and in ads. Often, people on the other end of the phone seem surprised that the phone rang. I ask what they do with the information they get from callers, and they tell me nothing. In fact, the person on the other end of the phone gets defensive when I ask if the company intends to use the information from my call to build a database or give feedback to management. This is misplaced and unwarranted defensiveness, as if the person on the other end of the line is afraid that an admission to collecting information amounts to an espousal of big brotherism. As I have shown in Chapter 3, that fear is completely out of date. we have to find ways to communicate to our customers and would-be customers that any information they supply us with is intended to help us better respond to their needs. One notion of the shape of things to come is suggested by CyberGold, a Silicon Valley startup taking an all-electronic approach to advertising. It pays net surfers to read about a company's products and services and to supply demographic data and answers to questions about their interests and preferences. The surfing consumer is given an account which accumulates cyberbucks that can be traded for cash, products, or services. But net shoppers get more than that. They are only asked to read about products and services that CyberGold matches to their stated needs or wants. Information is, in effect, traded for information. As a company accumulates such data, it will be able to use data mining techniques to develop detailed perspectives on customers' actions and buying patterns, invaluable aids to designing products and services for them. Take a lead from good science. Rapid and continuous adjustment based on regular sampling is the key to success in any fast-changing environment or field of study. It is essentially the same approach that the physicist Freeman Dyson has advocated in the interests of good science in the exploration of space. New discoveries, he argues, can change the questions that science asks, the priorities of scientific research, practically overnight. Hence, the tools of science should be versatile and flexible, or quite the opposite of the big space missions whose plans are set in concrete years in advance and are thus out of date by the time of launch, having been designed to answer questions for which no one now wants or needs answers. Far preferable to expensive major missions, Dyson says, are frequent and relatively cheap small missions. If we want to investigate seriously the question of life on Mars, the best way would be to plan a regular series of Mars missions, so that we could learn from the results of one mission the right questions for the next mission to ask. We could also learn from the mistakes of one mission how to avoid mistakes on the next. In almost any field of space science, whether we are exploring planets or galaxies or our own Earth, a series of modest missions is more likely than a single big spectacular to produce important discoveries. Think software. In the 21st century, software will be one of the most vital assets of any real-time corporation, on a par with a company's distribution system and R&D. Although in this book I have particularly emphasized communication software, the nervous system of a real-time infrastructure, it is not only the lightning-paced exchange of data that accounts for software's increasingly important position in the corporation. Software allows companies to reshape the very nature of their business. According to Jack Welch, the far-sighted leader of the General Electric Corporation, GE's goal is not to become smaller, but to get the small company soul and small company speed inside our big company body. It is the standardization yet flexibility of software that more and more is allowing even massive enterprises like GE to match the reflexes, adaptability, and intimacy of small shops closely in touch with their customers. Because software allows tighter collaboration and synchronization of all the spheres of a company's operations, every mission-critical bit of shared knowledge can play a galvanizing role across the network, joining everyone from the backroom researcher, designer, and production line supervisor to the salesperson, the service manager, supplier, partner, and customer. The unprecedentedly efficient marketplace resulting from this will ultimately be the creation of software, the most powerful of those transparent agents already affecting all of us. Learn by doing. Because there are neither signposts nor established paths to real-time management, organizations can really do no more than grope their way toward it. Every day they grapple with the unknown, what is yet to be, much like an artist facing a blank canvas. This groping is ground zero for all creative enterprises, and as the psychologist Rollo May has observed, artists only discover what they can and should be doing by encountering or immersing themselves in their subjects. Would-be leaders of real-time organizations learn by doing. They take a calculated risk and act on what they do know, even when that little is far outweighed by all that they don't know about the appropriateness or consequences of their actions. They learn to gauge what they should try next from the smallest shift in the wind. As noted by Kim Polese, the former Sun manager in charge of marketing for Java, an entire strategy can be reoriented in the blink of any eye. Implementing the technologies of real time is the best and only guide to their likely evolution and significance. Advice that my old friend Steve Jobs, co-founder of Apple, Next, and Pixar, both gives and takes himself. Start somewhere. This is what I call the beachhead approach to cultural change. Think small. Something as trivial seeming as putting all employees on an email network can become a powerful hidden agent of change. Spend enough money and time so that that one application and one example are successful. Use incentive systems to drive your organizational culture forward. Reward people for communicating and sharing information, for building databases that give consumers greater access, for telecommuting. Give people computers to work on at home, to interact with one another, service customers, answer email. And don't let yourself be paralyzed by fear of failure. Remind all employees that in Silicon Valley, part of the legend of the microchip champion Intel is the stream of losing products the company put out in the 1980s. Intel kept moving, learning from its errors, treating each failure as if it were one of Freeman Dyson's mini missions to outer space. The Inside Service Network. Unfortunately, in most organizations, we still view service as fixing things after the fact. To build a real-time culture, the different segments of organizations must learn to serve each other's needs proactively, just as they must learn to do for outside customers. To this end, tools such as databases and intranet browsers to search them can be acquired and put to work now. So, for instance, in real time, a salesperson in a large corporation making a bid on a big project in Tokyo should be able to order a search within his own organization back in Peoria for expertise he lacks and for missing pieces of the solution. He should be able to notify a sales manager in Hong Kong of key influences on the Tokyo customer's decision that happened to be located in her territory and enlist her help. He should be able to access the office of his corporation's president to see if the president can make a trip to Japan to close the deal. Openness to exciting new ideas, along with a willingness to implement them, elicits from employees the sort of wild, round-the-clock dedication famously advertised on T-shirts worn by members of an Apple development team in the mid-80s. 90 hours a week and loving it. The ever-evasive future. More than a decade ago, the Conference Board surveyed chief executive officers running large companies in the United States, Europe, Canada, and Latin America. A major finding of the study was that these corporate chieftains believed the future of their businesses would be significantly different from the past, and in ultimately unpredictable ways. What the report said then is even truer today. In this environment, management, anxious to anticipate as many surprises as they can, probably produce more short-term and long-term forecasts on more subjects than ever before. But there is not much confidence in the result, and these forecasts are given limited credence as a basis for business and management action. Of course, competition, turbulence, and unpredictability have always been prominent features of the business scene. However, these themes have become sufficiently strong in top management thinking to dominate strategies and shape management emphasis. The exciting challenge confronting managers is to soar in a spirit of adventure toward a horizon that may take just about any shape or form. Real-time message. Companies will learn about the technologies of real time in the only way they truly can, by adopting them and putting them to practical use. They will deploy them not to predict the future, but to live virtually on top of changing patterns and trends affecting every sphere of their business environment, making rapid and continuous refinements in their way of doing business. Epilogue. There are times when we in the high technology community feel a little defensive. When, for instance, some guru or other jumps on a soapbox to proclaim that computers have failed to live up to the expectation that they would boost productivity more dramatically than any other 20th century invention, and that they probably never will. Listening to this sort of thing, we feel a bit like Galileo's ghost, who had to wait 3.5 centuries to hear the Vatican concede in 1992 that the Earth is not a fixed body, but revolves around the sun. the story told by the official numbers from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, Productivity and Testing is that productivity growth has slowed since the early 1970s. The numbers suggest that in service industries, productivity growth has declined sharply. Yet, over this same period, American businesses have invested a steadily increasing share of their new capital equipment dollars in information technology. Economists discussing the technology's failure to affect productivity in the way everybody thought it would refer to the problem as the productivity paradox. In the debate over this puzzle, careful thinkers have suggested that the yardsticks are the problem, that conventional measures of productivity cannot come to grips with the kinds of value that information technology has been adding to industry. In fact, applying these yardsticks to businesses transformed by computer and communications technologies may not only underestimate the positive contributions of these tools, but also produce absurd results. To the extent that ATMs lead to fewer checks being written, Eric Brynjolfsson at MIT's Sloan School of Management points out, they can actually lower productivity statistics. He also notes that the sorts of benefits ascribed by managers to information technology, increased quality, variety, customer service, speed, and responsiveness, are precisely the aspects of output measurement that are poorly accounted for in productivity statistics, as well as in most firms' accounting numbers. The measurement problems are particularly acute for information technology use in the service sector and among white-collar workers. Among the other good explanations for the so-called paradox is that new technologies, before they can deliver their promise, often require an extended phase of learning by those who use them and those who sell them. The horrors of the present transitional phase are well illustrated by the Internal Revenue Service's attempt at computerization, described in the New York Times in early 1997. The Internal Revenue Service has spent $4 billion developing modern computer systems that do not work in the real world. Arthur Gross, an assistant commissioner of Internal Revenue who was appointed 10 months ago to rescue the agency's efforts, said customer service representatives must use as many as 9 different computer terminals, each of which connects to several different databases to resolve problems. The failure of the modernization effort will mean years of frustration for taxpayers who get into a dispute with the IRS, especially one that involves records kept on 2 or more of its computer systems. As the IRS starts over, Mr. Gross said, it must abandon the Big Bang theory of integrating all of its own computers at once and instead improve operations piecemeal. Such staggering adaptations and adjustments in the behavior of many institutions and individuals have to accompany the exploitation of technology, and there is usually a time lag before the payoff. 20 years had to pass before the electrifications of factories yielded striking productivity gains. In those 2 decades, the portability of electricity made it possible to build factories in locations chosen to maximize workflow efficiency. Before the advent of electric power, factories could be constructed only where water wheels, steam engines, and power transmitting shafts and rods were close by. Far from there being a productivity paradox, the problem may simply be that economists, statisticians, and others whose job it is to monitor changes in productivity are just as impatient as the rest of us. Conditioned by the technologies of real time, they expect that these tools will themselves demonstrate their full potential in real time. And that could well be the greatest irony of the age. The agony of defeat. In the course of researching and writing this book, I have found little in American life to be immune from real-time conditioning, not even football games and football teams. Growing up as a boy in Pittsburgh, I, like everyone else I knew, was a devoted fan of the Steelers. It made no difference to us that the home team only made the playoffs once between 1933, the year it was formed as the Pittsburgh Pirates, and 1971, a stretch of nearly 4 decades before it became one of the top NFL teams of the 1970s. And I honestly cannot remember a single instance in those years of a coach, or anyone else for that matter, being blamed and then fired for the team's failure to win the national championship. Expectations are quite the contrary today. In January 1997, San Francisco 49ers coach George Seifert, who has a longer string of percentage victories to his name than any other coach in the history of the NFL, was virtually fired after the team lost the Western Division Championship. In 1994, of the five teams that make up the National Football Conference East, the Redskins, Cardinals, and Cowboys all had first-year coaches. The New York Giants had a second-year coach, and the Eagles had one who had actually lasted 4 years. Owners of football teams now want coaches to achieve greatness in a single season, if not one game. Who would have thought? We are all getting used to a steady diet of strange and impossible things, from the global to the political to the intimately domestic. Who would have thought that the late 1990s would find Walter Wriston, the former chairman and CEO of Citicorp, talking about an information standard, as opposed to, say, a gold standard, and stateless money in global currency markets? Technology has overwhelmed public policy. What annoys governments about stateless money is that it functions as a plebiscite on your policy. Today, if the president goes in the Rose Garden and says something dumb, the cross rate of the dollar will change within 60 seconds. This creates what I call the information standard. The information standard is more draconian than the gold standard because the government has lost control of the marketplace. Who would have thought that as of only a few months ago, I could call the 800 number of a financial software supplier for help with installation to receive instructions from a proficient technician whose baby was crying in the background? There this technician was in her home, somewhere in the United States, taking care of her newborn child, walking around and talking about the solution to my problem over her phone headset. Who would have thought when I started my consulting firm in 1970 that in 1997 I could say that I know we are doing well when all the offices are empty? We give our employees powerful portable computers with high-speed modems that allow them to stay in close touch with each other, whether they are in a client's office, on the road, or at home. Who would have thought that technology would be responsible for reuniting families during the workday? After the Industrial Revolution drove them first out of farms and then down miles and miles of freeways, often in divergent directions. Who would have thought that a day would come when my 3-year-old granddaughter would live next door and stop by my home office to play on the computer next to mine, to watch me talk on my business phone, surf the internet, send a fax, copy or print out a document, read and compose email and a book? I think I would have found it a lot easier to believe that in 1996, race car drivers would tear across a dry lake in northwestern Nevada in a competition to break the sound barrier at 760 miles an hour. After all, the first official land speed record, set in 1898 by one Gaston de Chazelot-Lobat, hurtling along at 24.5 miles an hour, had already been broken at least 24 times by my 10th birthday. It is not technological progress so much as its effects that astound and rivet us now. What all of this means is that, in doing business amidst the blizzard of change that will characterize the 21st century, an attitude of openness and a willingness to explore and take risks will be essential to perceiving opportunities to leverage the special and particular competitive advantages of any one company. Winning organizations will be run in the expectation of relentless shifts and readjustments in the marketplace, in customers' expectations, and in the behavior of competitors. Like Lewis Carroll's Queen, they will anticipate surprises 6 times a day before breakfast, with the unpredictable, the unexpected, and the impossible making up the stuff of everyday life. A real-time culture will be a corporate asset infinitely more valuable than the most intricate research and planning. That culture will be founded on a new interrelation between companies and customers, created by the capacity of fully integrated real-time systems for acute sensing, for dialogue, and for responsiveness, systems in touch with the marketplace 24 hours a day. And that is how managers will cope with the outstanding feature of the age of the real consumer, the eventuality of anything.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.